Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm not funny in particular, but
there were a couple
story is funny.
Yeah. Moments in this campaign.
It's a funny
sure.
story.
But when you mocked me. No, I'm kidding.
I definitely make fun of you and myself. If you think about this, you were completely anonymous, had no business getting into the biggest stage of politics, right? And myself and the early team had combined years of political experience totaling zero. Like, we had no business running a presidential campaign. Yet, we outlasted dozens of sitting senators, governors, representatives. Like I said, we built the Yang Gang with podcasts, memes, and math.
The Yang Gang, you're going to love this, because this is a book that you were hoping I would write, but it did not, and so Zach wrote it. For the first time ever, the Forward Podcast, two-part conversation with the most important author of our time, Zach Grauman.
Hey, man. That's an intro.
So it's fun because people who have gotten into the pattern know we do a lot of books here, a lot of authors on Monday, and then you and I come together on Thursdays often to talk about what's going on. So this is like a combination, a team up, where this is going to be both us discussing what's going on and, most importantly, discussing Long Shot, how political nobodies took Andrew Yang national, and the new playbook that let us build a movement by the campaign manager Andrew Yang for president, quote by yours truly on the jacket, saying, "My campaign would never have reached millions without Zach's leadership and strategies. Anyone who wants to make change in the world or who simply loves an incredible story should read this book."
Look at that. I will say it is weird. I've done a couple podcasts. I haven't come out yet, but I've done a couple pods and doing more. This is another one. It's weird talking about your own book, man. We've said this before. It's like weird writing one. It's now weirder talking about it.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, dude. You're like, I don't know. It's very uncomfortable. You're like, hey, thanks for reading my work of, I don't want to say work of art, but my work of labor of love, my child that I birthed to the world, Long Shot. I think the Yang Gang's going to like it, though.
The Yang Gang, you're going to love this, because this is a book that you were hoping I would write, but it did not, and so Zach wrote it. like, if you were hoping for blow-by-blow and scenes and something that feels a bit more like a screenplay or feature film, that's Long Shot. I think there is a movie called Long Shot, so when they make a movie out of this, they'll have to call it something.
They'll have to call it something cooler.
Something different. But your... write that it's personal when you write a book. I do think you have the healthiest relationship with a book I've ever seen from an author, first-time author, because most authors, you can sense that there's like a real thirst to try and get the book out there and have it validated. Where you have like a very healthy thing where you're like, yeah, I wrote a book, proud of it, like it.
Shrug.
People will...
I'm excited about the book, but it's not... you're talking about this a bit. I think... it's because we spent so much time, and I personally spent so much time trying to sell your book, and I loved your book. I was a fan of you, obviously, but I really, like, one of the reasons, probably the biggest reason I joined your presidential campaign was because the book was right, and I was into the book. And that was, for lack of a better phrase, a huge bitch to sell. Like, it was good.
It's funny,
it was
because
timely.
You had that experience.
Yeah, it was awful to sell. And we weren't, obviously we weren't just selling books, but as like the message itself was hard. And, you didn't make the New York Times bestseller list until you literally gave it as a gift to Liz Warren on one of the debate stages with, you know, tens of millions of people watching. And we are already a sensation. You were already a national figure then, right? So it's... books are hard. The best, you know, some of the best books that make the bestseller list or, you know, make millions of dollars, they sold a couple, like, thousands of copies. We're talking tens of thousands of copies, not hundreds of thousands. So books are hard. It's a different market. So, I mean, for me, I'm excited it's out there. I think it'll do, like, it'll be fine. And there's been a lot of you have reached out and said you're really interested, and a lot of you bought it, which is exciting. But also, I think it'll stand the test of time. I think it's a good story, and it'll be there for later in my career and life and stuff. Hopefully, you know, my kids will read it someday. It'll be fun.
Again, a very, very healthy relationship. So we were joking about my first book that came out when I was the head of a nonprofit. And you were like, oh, I should have written a book when I was still the head of a nonprofit, because then it becomes this gift for the supporters of the nonprofit, and the org wants to get behind it.
Yeah. So, like this machine of people hyping it up.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, it kind of has this wholesome tinge.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you my arc and why I can relate. So I started Adventure for America in 2011.
Yep.
And then in 2012, I was named one of the 100 most creative people in business by Fast Company.
Wow. Do you apply for that, or they just came out of nowhere and said, we like you?
It was totally random. Okay. What happened was I met one of the editor of Fast Company at the time, Robert Safian.
Got it.
And he just was like, huh. and then, a month later, someone's like, hey, we think you should be on this list. And at the time, I was like, well, dope. You know, anything that helps get the message out about the org. And so I then, 6 months later, got a call from a literary agent saying, hey, have you thought about writing a book?
And the reason, called you.
The literary agent called me because they had paid like a scout who was like a junior agent who was meant to kind of look for interesting author prospects.
Wow.
So she found me from the Fast Company list. And so I got an email from someone saying, hey, I represent Bird Lavelle, literary agent.
Right.
You should write a book. We want to have lunch with Bird. And so it was very flattering. I mean, you Google, the agent's very legit, and you know, Bird's a very legit agent. And so I have lunch with him, and he's like, hey, and Bird's like a handsome, well-dressed guy, like, he'd be like, hey, did you totally write a book? Like, they'd be great. Like, it was very
That's awesome.
Flattering. But here's the funny part is that I said no, because I was like, I'm busy trying to start this nonprofit. Writing a book seems like a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure quite how it helps drive things for my nonprofit. So as flattering as this is, I just don't think I have the time or the energy.
Right. That is, I mean, it's one of the reasons why, what's the joke? Like, those who can't do teach, which I don't really love. But you know, there's some of it's like, part of the reason you start teaching is because you're not able to do, right? Like, if you are teaching or writing or doing that, you're not operating as much. And it's very difficult to write a book in general. It's harder to do it when you've got other things on your plate, particularly a startup organization. So I felt that I had COVID working to my advantage. So instead of like going out some nights because there was nowhere to go and crank on a book,
2020 was a good year to crank on a book. It's true.
But no one recruited me to write the book. I had to, you know, I don't want to say beg, but I had to go out and ask some agents, would you be interested in this story?
Well, hey, just the fact you got an agent and you got a publisher is a big deal and accomplishment.
Yeah, it felt great. And I mean, here's what I've been saying about the book is that the book is about our campaign, and it's I'm not funny in particular, but the story is funny.
Yeah, about moments.
It's a funny story, but
when
the book
you mocked me. No, I'm kidding.
I definitely make fun of you and myself.
I mean, you know, it's like accurate. Like, is it really sure?
Yeah. But I would say, as much as the book is about the campaign and you and our journey, it's actually not about you. And that's kind of why I wanted to write it is that if you think about this. You were completely anonymous, had no business getting into the biggest stage of politics, right? And myself and the early team had combined years of political experience totaling zero. Like, we had no business running a presidential campaign. Yet, we outlasted dozens of sitting senators, governors, representatives. We raised hundreds or millions, almost $40 million from hundreds of thousands of donors in small increments. We popularized a lot of policies, not just cash relief, a bunch that are still talked about or implemented today. You outpolled our sitting vice president in her home state, qualified for 7 debate stages. All these things happened, right? And we did not particularly know what we're doing. We had no experience, right? So to me, that is not just telling about you, but that's telling about a bigger picture. And there's something bigger there. And that's why I want to write about, like, the game has changed, like, split between what the media is doing, the traditional way of doing things, and where most Americans are. And you and I were very clear-eyed in that from the beginning. So that's why I wanted to write, because I felt like it needed, like, the takeaway from Andrew in your campaign is not UBI, and it's not that this random guy ran for president. The takeaway from Andrew in the campaign was that the game has changed, and we just built a brand and a movement because of that almost overnight. So that's why I wrote it, and I hopefully got that message across.
So you say that we had a grand total of 0 years of political experience, and that's no accident in the sense that anyone I talked to who had political experience was so negative on the idea.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? There was an inverse relationship between political experience and thinking Andrew Yang should run for president.
Yes.
For sure.
Yes. I grew up, I was always fascinated. My mom was a teacher. My dad was an engineer type. So I was always interested in like for-profits and nonprofits, how they work together. And while I wanted to be a teacher coming out of college, I was close to taking a job for Venture for America, like Save the World, like Mom. I had a ton of student loan debt, so I took the Wall Street job. Which is the other job offer I had. So I started working on Wall Street in New York, but I started volunteering. I started Suit Up.
How close did you come to joining Teach for America out of college?
And close. I mean, mainly because I didn't have that many job offers. I was not good. I tried the, like, I don't know if you ever, you guys listening have ever done the, tried to do the consulting path. Did you explore, like?
No, I did not, but I know it well.
So, like, you know the paths. It was, like, investment banking, consulting, there's law, medicine, and what's the fifth one? Or there's six.
There's tech, and then academia.
Business school. Yeah, okay. So I was not, there's these things called case studies that consultants make you do, which is like, how many ping pong balls fit into the Empire State Building? Or look at this, you know, here's this problem this company's having. How would you solve it? And I was awful at them. Awful. Like, so, like, I've never, it was one of the few things I've, like, really, really tried and just, like, just my brain doesn't think like that big. Like, I don't, I'm either too big picture or too in the weeds in the, on the fly like that. And so I didn't have that many job offers to answer your question. I could have worked at a marketing firm, kind of. And then the big two were Teach for America in post-Katrina New Orleans with special needs kids, or work on Wall Street at UBS. And I remember walking around campus, like, really hating the decision, because you can either, like, have a good impact and help a lot of people, make no money, or make some money but not really care about your impact at all or have any impact. I hated that. But I was close. Like, Teach for America, they kind of forgive your federal loans. They do some good stuff. So I would have got,
because you owed almost $200,000.
Yeah, it was like about 200.
Which is a lot.
It's a lot. And then with interest in it, you know, it just ended up being two. I think I ended up paying like 240, something around that range. And that's like with like a, my parents helped out for like a semester or so. And
college is fucking expensive, man.
Yeah, jeez. Dude. And then I got some scholarship money. It was awful. My brother did a master's because he kind of had to find, like, he was, because he was graduating in 2000. You know, like, we were both graduating in 2010, 2011. Like, it wasn't, they weren't good times to be trying to get into banking, if you will, as post the 2008, 2009 kind of crisis.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech, who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang. So you made the big choice to move to New York City.
Yeah.
And join UBS.
Join UBS. I was, that's the thing. I was like, I did it for the money. Like, my first salary was like around probably like 60 grand a year. I mean, there was a bonus, but it wasn't huge. I remember I had like $200 in my bank account. I had a mattress, like a crock pot. That was pretty much what I moved with. And like a little bit of clothes. And you know, a shit ton of debt. That was pretty much it. So I was like rent, and then loans start at like $800 a month. Yeah. Like that's where they really get, you have 6 months to, you know, save up a bit. Like, and rent was whatever, 1700, 1800. It was not a good time, but also like a fun time. New York City is a really good city to be
young
rent
and
poor in,
yeah.
You know,
because
you can.
Because you had roommates in that jazz,
you can
right?
be roommates, you can live on top of each other, you can find social opportunities. That
we actually
cheap.
Met through one of your roommates, right?
Yeah. So my roommate, Joe Guy, one of them, he's got the Joe Guy. I always be like, every time I was mad at him, I'd be like, no more Mr. Nice Guy. He's a really good guy. But Joe Guy's a really good guy. But he worked at Venture for America and was like excited
sure.
about it. So that's how we met. I was working at UBS. I started SuitUp. And I was looking for legitimacy. And that's the thing we felt on the presidential campaign.
So SuitUp, you talk about it in the book in detail, but SuitUp is the nonprofit that you founded while doing your day job. So it was kind of a lot.
Yeah. So like I saw two things. I started volunteering a lot just to keep my sanity for like just pushing paper, if you will, or making rich people richer. I was in wealth management. And started volunteering at this school down in Coney Island, near Coney Island, Brooklyn. And we asked the kids, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Like that, you know, just like, and it wasn't like a specific survey. It was just like the annual survey, right? And they all said, they were middle schoolers, and they all basically said they want to be like LeBron James or Nicki Minaj. It was like, or Beyonce. It was like athlete or pop star. It was like 80% or so of the kids. And it was like heartbreaking in a sense, because I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. But these kids didn't know what they could be. They didn't know their options, generally speaking. Or like dentist, doctor, whatever, the maybe more traditional career path seemed just as far-fetched as LeBron, right? But the other thing I saw was at UBS is that we being corporate America, were pretty bad at volunteering. We would do like, we do park cleanups and soup kitchens. We build terrible houses. We went and scraped barnacles off the side of the Intrepid, which is a military boat here in New York, in like 100 degree heat in August. It was awful. Such a terrible day. And I just remember, like, why do these companies suck so much at this? It's like they don't care and it's not easy for them. So I started just running my own volunteer days for my team at UBS. And I was like, my kids would love to work with you guys for a day. So we did something I thought would be fun would be like just a business competition for a day. So we brought my team from UBS down to a school in Brooklyn. And the kids were tasked with being the CEO of Nike for a day and had to create a new Nike shoe. And so they had to divide into teams of like 10. They got assigned UBS coaches. And they had to, you know, design a new shoe for Nike. So they had to pick a target market and design and brand the shoe and you know, pick a celebrity endorsement and then act out a commercial or make a marketing pitch. And then the winning team got real money. They got like an Amazon. Well, I learned the hard way. Don't give them real cash. You can't do giving middle schoolers cash. But you give them an Amazon gift card, like the real world. And you say to them, like, you work hard in school, you get an A. But you work hard in the real world, you get paid. And what happened was, like, everybody, I mean, I say this like humbly, but everybody loved it. It was like, wow, my volunteer day was actually fun. And the kids, like, you could see them, like their eyes lighting up, like, oh shit, this is why I do math, so I can add up how much my shoe's gonna cost. Like, it was just like this connection for, and I had, you know, I've done it now where teachers have cried to me, and you know, the kid that's got the hoodie on in the corner all day is the one that lights up the room because of a project like this. And what happened was, I was working at UBS, and we did this once or twice at UBS, and then some guy from PIMCO called me, like the asset management fund. He's like, hey, my friend did this volunteer thing. Can you guys do it for PIMCO? I was like, I mean, I guess so. That sounds fun. The next thing you know, I got more and more companies calling, and I started a nonprofit. And now I'm proud to say it's the $1 million organization. We've got 9 full-time employees, and we worked with everybody. You can name a company, at least in New York, like probably 150 corporate partners and tens of thousands of kids and volunteers.
So you show up to work in 2010, and then you start this when?
2014. So I was like, but I'd like effed around. I'd like dabbled. I founded the org, like LLC, or the 501c3 was 2014. But probably a year and a half in, I started like really seeing what this could be. But I iterated a lot.
Anyone who wants to check it out can go to volunteersuitup.org to see. It's a thriving nonprofit that Zach started. So you started in 2014, and then Joe introduces the two of us in what, 15, 16?
Yeah, when I was looking to be more legit. So I was looking, so in the campaign, we were looking for legitimacy. And this is a big thing, especially we're selling to legitimate buyers, right? Let's call it companies. They wanted to know, was I real? Was this a legitimate thing, right? So I was looking just for like cool people to say, hey, we put your name on it. So I remember meeting with you, and I was excited to meet with you because you also were, you had started a nonprofit. It was stuff I wanted to pick your brain on. And you, I gave you a pitch like, this is great. And you asked a couple questions. He's like, this is awesome, man. How can I help? And I was like, can you join our advisory board? The ask is literally just let me put your name on the website so I can say, yeah, these are cool people that think this is a good idea. And you like did not miss a beat, like, absolutely, man. And it was like very Andrew Yang, like, yeah, let's do it. Which I love. We'll always respect that because it costs you essentially nothing. I mean, like if the org, was, stealing money or something, I guess maybe it would hurt you, but that's probably it. But it helped me tremendously, right? Because I was looking, the model is companies pay us to run the volunteer days. So it's essentially a business. So I was, when having Andrew Yang, I was able to get other people, and then, and now I don't have a legitimacy problem anymore, which is great, but that's the hardest part when you're first starting out, you know?
Well, you know, other companies just look at the company roster and are just like, yeah.
Yeah, now like, oh, yeah, well, Goldman did it, that's all.
But it is a startup thing. You have to find a way to give yourself that legitimacy halo. Mm-hmm. If you're a serial founder, then you can skip that part sort of, because everyone's like, oh, like, you know, you.
Yeah, right. That's once you, it's your first, I mean, you're 24, right? I'm like trying to earn my stripes.
That was impressive. And then you and I connected a couple of years later when I was talking about automation and trying to run for president. I remember when and you write about this in detail in the book, where you're like, oh no, Yang, I have to sit through a Venture for America spiel. But then it's like, wow, this is different. And like, I went down a totally different path.
So you used to, I was in corporate strategy when SuitUp was like really taking off, and I was running, and so I had these two jobs, and my boss at the time was like, well, look, why don't you check out our client philanthropy team, which didn't really exist. It was big, we were big in Europe, but we weren't big in the Americas, which is the biggest philanthropy market in the world. We give, the United States gives more than any other country, pretty much combined. Like, we are huge, big, big charity world here. And so helped build this team that helped our biggest clients give money to charity. So I used to invite, used to come to a bunch of philanthropy events.
The UBS events were such a blast.
A ton of fun. And it was always a hit. So it's funny because like when Andrew eventually told me he was, getting into politics, I had seen him somewhat debate and knew you had like the chops to kind of cut through really well. Because I'd seen you on panels and speaking and stuff. But I was at these Jeffersonian roundtable discussions, which is like a pretentious way I talk about in the book of like just like 15 people talking about a topic. And you actually hammer it in your new book Forward on like, what do you call it, constructive institutionalism? Yeah, which is a lot of people just talking about the problems and potential solutions, but no one actually doing anything. It was very much like that. And this was on the future of work. You were not on the invite list, or maybe on the invite. You were on the guests, like the RSVP list. And you showed up. I'm like, I don't want to hear the Yang Venture for America pitch again. Also, like, you were like a level above me in terms of like charisma and like accomplishment. So I was like, oh, Yang's going to suck the energy out of the room from what I was trying to get, right? So I was like, oh, damn it. And then you came in and did essentially the automation bomb. And you were like, this was fresh, guys. This was 2017, maybe summer. I have the dates in the book. It was early. It might have been spring. It's fresh off the 2016 election. And you're like, talking about, these are the top five jobs in the United States. Most people in half the country works in them. And what do they all have in common? We're going to automate them away. If you don't believe me, Look at manufacturing. We've already automated half of these. And where do we do it? Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio. What do they all have in common? Those are states that went from blue to red. They flipped the Trump in 2016, and that's why he won. And then you said, we need to go to universal basic income as soon as possible. So I'm running for president on a platform of universal basic income in 2020. And the room is like silent. Like, president of America? Like, president of the country? And that joke never gets old for me, because that's literally everything everybody's thinking. But it hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, some of these folks are like laughing or didn't get it. And the rest was just like, after that, they're just picking you apart on whether or not you could win or politics. But for me, I don't know why. I think it's because, you know, I grew up middle class. I grew up like kind of like kick and scratch and crawl my way just to get a, you know, out of loans, like out of student loan debt. And it just didn't feel like a very sustainable path for my friends from high school, who I thought were smart and talented, but maybe not great at school. And like the folks that were left behind in the economy or struggling in the economy more than I was, this all checked out. It all resonated really well, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are parts of Connecticut that certainly resemble this, post-industrial former manufacturing towns. The other thing is that you'd seen the limits of big philanthropy and you were like, well, this isn't going to solve the problem.
Yeah, I knew no one was going to solve it. Like, I knew the people with money had no idea this was happening and would not know how to do it, how to fix it if they did. Because I'd seen billionaires, people with quote-unquote unlimited money, still not be able to solve fucking problems.
Yeah,
because those are hard. The other thing is, my dad lost his job, had some job transition stuff when I was a kid. And I've seen the impact of that on families. It's awful. And my dad was able to bounce back, and like it wasn't like a long, long period of time. But it still is, but less so. But there's a real tie between a man and his identity and his family in terms of providing.
Yeah.
And that was rough. My dad was great about it, but I learned it more as I got older. I was able to look back, but just imagining like entire communities dealing with what my dad dealt with was like, of course. Like, and who would you blame? Like, whoever's in charge. Who was in charge during this time? The Clintons, right? It totally made sense. And for some reason, like no one got it. I was just shocked people weren't jumping out of their seats to help you, you know? And then, you know, the longer I did, the more it made sense knowing what I knew about philanthropy and
donors. And your book goes into that in painstaking detail. It's sort of fun reliving the fancy salons of the early days where people would be very happy to share an opinion and not as happy to roll up their sleeves or do anything. So I remember that dinner too. I had just finished like a rough draft of the first part of the book. So when you and I were connecting later, like I was like, ooh, I'm gonna like send you chapters as they're done. So you kind of see the book come together in real time. But I remember at the end of that dinner, you said to me, hey man, like I wanna help. And then I was like, wow, Zach would be great. And I'm not sure if you and I used the words campaign manager, even that.
I think it was like implied that it'd be like a leadership position, but it was, we had talked about finance director too. We weren't sure, I think. I'm not sure.
But I remember walking out being like, if I get Zach, that would be a freaking home run. And I wasn't sure if it was going to be campaign manager or finance either. I knew that you'd obviously worked with a lot of rich people at UBS. Yeah. So I was like, that's a win. But also you were a social entrepreneur that I knew that like had been through a bunch. And so that like I came away feeling like, wow, I really have to try and get Zach out of this campaign. And I don't know I didn't know how serious you were at the time because it's like, well, it's obviously a big fucking leap to go from very sought after corporate job to the crazy presidential campaign, which is one reason why I resolved to send you chapters of the book as they were being written.
Yeah. I remember, it's so funny because when writing this book, I got to dive into like our correspondence at the time, and I found some old emails and such. And you had said like, let's get caught, let's catch up, let's get lunch or something. And we ended up getting coffee a couple blocks away from my office. And you show up, you hand me, you like slid it to me almost, it was like pretty almost, I don't think you intended to be dramatic, but it was almost kind of dramatic, like sliding the book across the table. But you handed me Andy Stern's book called Raising the Floor. And you crushed a brownie there, which was hilarious. And I didn't even know, you're just like, nom, 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 and like talking, nom, nom, nom. It was awesome. But it was telling about UBI, your plans. And then I remember you showing me, I talk about this in the book, but the Washington Post has like a cool infographic on how much money people raised in the prior elections. And I said, you know, do you think you can win? What's your plan? And you were like, well, you know, it's what we really have to raise like $2 million. And I think I can do that with techies who are interested in universal basic income and the Asians. There's no Asian American candidates really in the field. And then if I can get, and here's what the Republicans did, and you were showing me, it was like, and the Republicans use super PAC money, so numbers are different. But if you looked at like, you know, Mike Huckabee and Chris Christie and folks, like we could, you know, we're like, if we could raise what they raised, they didn't raise that much. And like, so if you raise what they raised, you'd be theoretically as legitimate, right? So there was a plan. And then you sent me a really positive email. I can't wait to, I quote it in the book, but it's like, you know, let's go change the world or something. Like, I'm on fire for this, something like that. A very classic entrepreneur against the world type energy. But yeah, it was, it wasn't until I read the whole book where I was like, yeah, I'm in.
Wow.
Yeah. I eventually got the book in piecemeal, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm super grateful to your brother Jordan because it sounds like he put you up to it, and in part, I appreciate the fact that you guys are reading it together too.
Yeah, so I said to Jordan, like, all right, you read it, I'll read it, because we both like he had another year or two of getting out of debt. I was finally out of debt. That's like my timing. I'm like, all right, I'm out. Like, I feel like I just wasted fucking years of my life. I get you to do something crazy that matters, and I always thought I want to run for office someday. So I was like exploring politics in some ways. Regret that. I don't regret that decision, but like, you know,
well,
little did I know.
Yeah, we overexposed you to politics.
Conrad Taylor on our, who was on our campaign too, was like political diehard. And then he did the mayor's race more in depth, and he's like, I don't think I can do this. But yeah, you, but we both read it together, and it was like, you know, let me know what you think. You know, we'll give our judgment separately. And I jumped out of my bed during part of it where it was like, and there's some data in there that we don't talk about enough.
Agree.
The biggest one was, I mean, not the biggest one, but the one that like hit home to me was that everybody talks about, you know, wealth inequality. The numbers are crazy. You go down, like the average income of certain demographics in the United States are awful. Like the average income of a black male was what, $11,000 or net worth?
Net worth is like 11,000. Something like 10% of that of a white family.
It was awful. And then the other thing was, of the rich, the people that are quote unquote succeeding in this economy, they're just as miserable. Like their mental health, their happiness, their future prospects, you name it, everybody's miserable. So this isn't even working for the rich. And I was like, holy cow. And you actually had some solutions in there, you know, like UBI, you know, obviously he's never like, nothing's a silver bullet, but it would theoretically alleviate a lot of this pain, right? So, yeah, I was like, well, I think my brother said to me, like, you're an idiot. He said, you're like, you're full of shit in terms of you say you want to change the world, say you want to like leave a legacy and have an impact in this place. You're full of shit if you don't take the job. Because at the end of the day, the book was right. Like, you were right. And I still believe that. And that, you know, win or lose, we're going to be right.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. No, so I will say that writing The War on Normal People was almost like a spiritual experience for me.
So it's like that, what's that song in Hamilton? I wrote my way out.
Yeah, it really was. I wrote my way out. So I'm going to backtrack a little bit. So I eventually call an agent back and be like, hey, like, what does it mean to write a book? When I was trying to elevate the profile of Venture for America, and I realized a book might be helpful.
Yeah.
And so I wrote that book, and it had, you know, some modest success. And then I just forgot about it. I was like, well, all right, just like
wrote a book. There we go.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, that's that. And when I say modest success, I mean, like, frankly, like, it felt disappointing at the time. Because
really?
Because I think if you're anyone aside from you, Zach, like, you write a book and you imagine that people are going to be like, this is, like, really important. Like, tell their
that's
friends
it. That's
and, like,
it.
The rest
that's
of it.
That's it. Like, imagine if I wrote a book my first time, I wasn't familiar with the space. I'd be like, it's going to be a New York Times bestseller. Everybody who reads it is going to love it. Tell all their friends. I'm going to sell thousands of copies. The reality is you're going to sell 50 with your closest friends and family if you're lucky, and then you'll skid your way to a couple hundred and no one will give a shit. That's probably the first author's, you know, traditional path, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, so in my case, I sold, you know, I mean, I sold, you know, whatever, like 10,000 copies or something like that.
Yeah.
And
it's great. Your first book?
Yeah.
That was wonderful.
Thanks.
That's what I'm saying. The nonprofit probably helped. You got all the fellows.
Nonprofit helped.
Got,
yeah, I mean, a lot of people, like people had to.
The book is good, though.
Read it if they wanted to apply.
Yeah.
No, they did not have to read it if they wanted to apply.
But you totally would.
A lot of them
apply for VFA. Like, read the book. Of course. I mean, you're selling a vision, too. Like, that's. Of course. Absolutely. Most people who joined the campaign read the book, right?
So it became like the, you know, a document for
yes.
people who are
your manifest
interested your in Venture for America.
Yes.
So that's in 2014, and then I decided to run for president in 2017. I call my agent, Bird, and I'm like, hey man, I want to write another book. It's about automation, UBI, Fourth Industrial Revolution. It's gonna be like the foundation of my presidential campaign. So we write a book proposal, and it's like, Andrew Yang, entrepreneur, is gonna run for president on the ideas in this book.
Sold 10,000 last time.
Yeah. and so this was, I guess, somewhat discouraging. So the first thing you do is you go back to your previous publisher, in this case, HarperCollins, and be like, hey, your author, Andrew Yang, is gonna write the book. What do you think? And then HarperCollins has passed. and then Bird's
they're
like,
it's hurting, though. Right? They had some other issues, I think.
No, they were fine. Oh, okay. Like, they just weren't interested.
Like, no, thanks.
Yeah. So then Bird's like, okay, Harper has passed. We're now going to go to other publishers and pitch, like, you know, this book. So we got very, very few bites.
Yeah.
It was, you know, like Bird, who's incredibly positive, was actually concerned, like not sure if this book's going to find a publisher. And so then Hachette ended up making an offer, and it was pretty much the only offer. So, you know, thank you, Paul Whitlatch.
Paul.
And then Bird was like, take this offer. Like, there was no like, oh, we should like that. He's like, take the offer.
It.
So I was like, all right, I take it. And then that summer, I wrote The War on Normal People, and it felt like there were all of these ideas that I'd had on some level, but had never really fleshed out.
Mm.
And so I'd go around and find facts, and then the facts were, frankly, staggeringly, like, you know, concerning.
Well, you were also front row seeing, like, the byproduct of this, right? Like, you're seeing the young superstars come out of college, right?
And
like,
yeah, I had that vantage point. I'd spent 5 years in the Midwest and the South, so I had that vantage point. So I was stringing together these thoughts that became chapters for War on Normal People. And then when the book was done, I felt very vividly, I was like, if this is the best thing I ever do, I'm fine with it.
Really?
Like if this book is major contribution to American life or the world, like, fine. Like, this is the best I'm ever going to do.
Yeah.
And then that book, when it came out in early 2018, to your earlier point, did not make a dent.
No.
Like, people were not, and at that point you'd read it and you were also like me being like, hey, this book's really good and important. Like,
yes,
you know, no,
more people need to read. Everybody needs to read this. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's interesting, and like, fast forward to today. So I wrote another book, Forward. The War on Normal People still is like the go-to book for me. Like, it's, you know, frankly, like, you know, like it sold now. Last I checked, The War on Normal People sold something like 175,000 copies.
Hachette that really nailed that one, you know?
Yeah, Paul Woodlodge is like a very,
they
you
took
know,
a good swing.
Like now he seems
good ROI for Hachette.
Because again, no publisher, like in that book proposal, it said, hey, Andrew Yang's running for president. No publisher took that seriously.
Yeah.
Even Hachette, which ended up buying the book, did not take it seriously. But imagine being the editor who took a flyer on the Andrew Yang book 15 months later when Andrew Yang's like hawking the book on the Democratic debates. Then like ding, 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 and people would be like, oh. So Bird, my agent, later said to me, he was like, Andrew, you like, I have never seen anyone follow through on a proposal better than you did, because you were like, I'm gonna run for president, we're gonna make him, and like, and he said like no publisher believed that.
Yeah, none.
But then we actually did do it. So the importance that you're putting on The War on Normal People when you were deciding whether to join the crazy campaign or not, makes me feel really gratified, because like that book, getting you on board is like, you know, like the biggest deal for the success of the campaign. You know, I can imagine, because I have no idea what we would have done if you hadn't been there.
Yeah, hiring in the early days is very difficult.
Which you saw talk about in the book, where you showed up and you were like, oh fuck, what am I getting myself into?
Oh yeah, dude. Well, so I say I did my due diligence. I talked to a bunch of your former people, because I knew them from Joe Guy, my old roommate, and then his former bosses, and one like Mike Tarullo used to have essentially my job at Venture for America, at least for a bit. I went to college with him, so I talked to him for a bit. And everybody had really good things to say, but the biggest one was that Joe Guy said it best. He's like, I'll never say anything bad about Andrew Yang, because being a part of it was life-changing. Like, it put me on a different trajectory of what I could be in my life. And I think I've had that reaction from a lot of people who work closely with you on the campaign, and that you are... And what I learned from you is that Andrew is a magic maker, and I try to be a magic maker. It's like you've sheer force of will. You're like, we're gonna fucking run for president, and we're gonna make it the fucking debate stage, and the Asian's gonna line up, the techie's gonna line up. I don't know how, but we're gonna do it. And if you disagree with me, respectfully, get the fuck out of my way. Like that. Like that's how you operate, which I love. I really love, and it's a really good. It's like almost. Not completely blind optimism, but it's almost, right? Where it's because you do look at the negatives, and you're a very rational, logical guy. But you're like, I'm choosing to ignore those because we have to be laser focused on the right mission. So anyway, so I join. I'm like, Andrew's got me this all hyped up. I'm all jacked up. It's my first day. We're like, hey, we're staying in my mom's apartment in Hell's Kitchen for a little bit till we, you know, figure out our campaign. Yeah. And there was a guy living there, but I showed up and I was like, you know, it's like the first day in the rest of my life type energy. And I get there and it's like Muhan's not even awake yet. The guy living in the apartment, it smells like dude. There's just boxes of books. Like, fuck, there's a picture of this like in the book. There's boxes of books everywhere. There's nowhere to sit, really.
It's not a great
Wi-Fi
environment.
Is not fast enough for three or four people. It was, and like no one's worked on a campaign before. Like Frawley, who ended up running our merch, was like he worked in digital advertising. He's like 23, I think. Muhan was like an engineer from Venture for America startup that didn't go well. And me, and then eventually Carly and Matt. And Matt was like a LSAT teacher at the time, like brilliant policy wonk, but. No politics. Carly never worked on a campaign. Yeah, that was pretty. And there were a few others, but that was.
I remember you showing up, and then the apartment, you know, was not suitable for anything. And then one of my first things was like, "Hey, man, go find us an office."
Yes.
And you did a great job. You found us a dope.
We found a fun office that we ended up taking over that building in a way.
Yeah. So the office on 39th Street, off of. Between 7th and 8th Avenues.
Yeah.
So it's adjacent to Times Square. It was right next to both a nice fast casual sushi place, next to a comic book shop I used to frequent in my 20s.
I stopped doing.
It was on 40th and 7th.
And right next to a sports bar called Carriger's that there was like a healthy smell of fried food coming out the windows.
So you found this office, and the office was hardwood floors, high ceilings, natural light.
Yep.
It was maybe like 2,800 square feet or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So, it had a really good vibe to it.
Yeah.
I don't know how into physical spaces you are. I'm pretty into them in the sense that if you have a place with natural light and hardwood floors and high ceilings and like has a good energy and people want to be there. I saw a couple of these spaces and I think I seized on that office and was like, we got to get this office. Was that right?
That sounds about right. Did a lot. Yeah, that was my first real big task was finding an office. And then you were crazy risk seeking, which I learned to love. But at first, like my brain could not handle. I remember looking at our financials, like, all right, we've got like, and we were always kind of tight. Like we were at like 3 months of burn. Which for those of you who've never really worked at a startup means if you don't raise any more money over the next 3 months, we will run out of cash based on like our current run rate, how much we're spending per month. And then it was like 3 months of burn. And then you walked in one day, you're like, guys, we just hired Matt Shinners. He's going to be our head of policy. And I was like, all right, move on. I think it's 1 month of burn now. but you were like, go for it. I remember we didn't have enough money to hire Carly. Well, no, we were trying to hire a video editor. Could not find one. We eventually hired this guy, Luke, for a bit, and then eventually leveled up to hire a bunch. But couldn't find one. But then we met Carly, who I didn't maybe love at the time, but I'm engaged to her now, so it's different. But at the time, not there. But we all loved her, and we're like, this is good energy. We couldn't, like, if we're honest.
Carly was clearly brilliant.
Yeah, she's, like, definitely special and was helpful. But we're like, she had no video editing skills, really. and you're like, just do it, man. This will work out. I'm like, okay, man. It did work out. Ballsy move, but because we could barely afford the video editor, which we still didn't hire at the time. But yeah, obviously she was a great hire for a number of reasons.
Yeah, I do remember you being like, hey, we have this much runway. And then I kept throwing logs in the fire and, yep. then the runway kept shrinking. I was like, yeah, don't worry about it. We'll get the money. That I was, confident on that score.
One of the things Frawley said to me early on, and I was like, it was one day you in particular, like super risk seeking. I'm like, I don't know what to do, man. Like, do I need it? Am I just along for the ride here? Because I don't think this makes any sense. And he goes, all I know about Andrew is that when his back is against the wall, he was not going to lose. Like, if you tell him, like, hey, payday's due tomorrow, we need to fucking raise all of it right now, like, he'll raise the money. That's true. You're good at that. I don't know if it's like a, it's not a procrastination thing. You're not like a,
I'm like a fairly buttoned up, hard nosed operator.
Yeah.
But the deltas at that point in the campaign just did not concern me.
Yeah.
I was like plus minus 50, 100 grand. Who
Whatever.
Cares?
Yeah. You didn't care. Then we'll figure it out. All right.
You know, it was like, look, we're trying to raise, millions, tens of millions. So it's
we
like,
level up or we don't.
Like if I have to worry about 100 grand, then we're kind of doomed.
Yes.
So don't worry about 100 grand.
That was it. And then we were scheduled, and that mentality like pretty much hit us once we booked Joe Rogan. So that was booked like 6 weeks in advance. Like it's, which I'm way getting ahead of myself, but we'd burned out. Like we were pretty much bankrupt that day. Like that's how I looked at it. I was like, all right, we're spending Joe better hit.
we can build up to that, but we're talking about, what was your first day of work on the campaign?
It was April, I think it was like March 1st.
2018.
Early March 2018.
All right. So let me tell everyone what happened in terms of before Zach joined. I was very eager for Zach to join. I was like, man, if Zach doesn't join, I don't know what we're going to do for leadership and like operational capacity.
Oh yeah. You also needed a peer. You had a bunch like Mulan, probably they're great guys, but they're a lot younger than you,
Yeah.
I got 11 years on me, something like that. But like at least I had almost a decade experience of like corporate America.
You were an adult.
That sort of thing. Yeah.
Probably a second adult. I mean, Shinners is an adult too, but Shinners wasn't as,
he was a couple weeks later too.
Yeah. He was a couple weeks later.
So
he had a different type of role.
Yeah.
So in 2017, I spent the fall in my mom's apartment with Muhan, just building the website, policies, putting the finishing touches on the book. And so the campaign was announced to the world in the New York Times in February of 2018, where it's like, you know, his message, the robots are coming.
Yes, his campaign message. And you had hat hair in the photo. I didn't know that at the time, but your hair, if you look at that photo, your hair is like...
Probably, yes. Almost certainly.
It's not a bad photo, though.
And then my book came out in April of 2018. So you joined between those two dates. And between those two dates, we were still very much finding our footing. The year you describe in the book, you know, that process where we were just getting our legs under us, a bit later in that year, and I'm surprised that you didn't go into detail in the book about this, but there was the Humanity First tour,
that
first tour, which was in 2018, and you were literally the bus driver. So one of the jokes on the campaign early on was that we were the shittiest drivers anyone had ever seen, because Carly, for all of her gifts, went away to school and was like not an experienced driver.
Carly can't drive. She, to her credit, she admits she's a bad driver, which I do love that about her.
That was a virtue. our videographer at the time, Luke Hansen. Luke, we love you. Poor driver.
Couldn't drive.
And for whatever reason, it came to you. You were like the camp counselor bus driver.
Yep.
And so we decide to go on this tour because Liam DeCliveloe, this freaking at the time 19-year-old, shows up at our doorstep and is like, hey, you know, I've got this like, you know, political vision and think that, you know, Yang is the right combination of this and that. But then for whatever reason, Liam's like, hey, you guys need to go on tour. And then I was like, that's stupid because no one would show up to said tour. Yep. And then he said, that's why you have to go on tour. And then for whatever reason, that logic worked on me. and then I turned to you and was like, hey, man, I think we should go on tour. And you, to your credit, this was like maybe the biggest lift in the campaign before or after, where you were like, all right, we're gonna do this tour. And that tour, holy shit, like where like it was so janky, where
so
we would
janky.
Show up in the bus and you and Carly, like I was blown away that you were sitting there together like erecting this like shoddy backdrop and stage. And not shoddy because, you know, you weren't awesome, just the fact that you would get in this bus
shoddy
and take the things out. And so we went to Pittsburgh, we went to Detroit, we went to Cleveland, I think.
It was Chicago, Cleveland, Pittsburgh. I think we added a couple bigger cities. Like that, we did Iowa, New Hampshire. They were in there. It's probably close to all of them. So a couple of these things made the cutting room floor, because there's only so much you can write about how shitty we were. And so I think that's where our editor's like, probably not. And also I was trying to keep it moving and keep it, you know, but so we did a couple of things. So this is fun. If anyone knows Liam, who runs Humanity Forward, the 501c4, he shows up to your, I just joined. So I was not aware of like the team calendar or Yang's meetings, that sort of thing. So he shows up like a couple weeks after I'd started to your mom's apartment. He's in high waters. He looks like he's 10. And he's a hyper nerd, like speaking a mile a minute, just all about political jargon and that sort of thing. And he sits me down. I'm like, who is this kid? What, Yang, what meeting have you just taken? Like, what is going on? And he sits me down and gives me this like framework for how someone should run for president. And we still use it on the, like, it's brilliant. And he's a political junkie. And he joined the Bernie campaign before he took off. He joined the Beto campaign. That's why he couldn't work for us full time at the time. He joined Beto before Beto O'Rourke was a thing in Texas. He's very, very good at finding these candidates. And Yang was like his third, looks like, hit, if you will. He's young. This is the type of people that would come in the office all the time. But then we did this Humanity First tour. I remember asking him, like, this is like the dumb questions we have to ask ourselves. Like, besides raising money, like, what are you supposed to do when you're running for president? Because you can't just go, I mean, you could like spend like that sounds like a dumb, stupid question, but actually think about it. Like, do you spend all your time like trying to talk to Iowa voters? Are you trying to get press all day long? Are you trying to throw a rally? Like, what are you supposed to do? And the answer is like, no one really knows. It's pretty much anything you want, but you want some form of to drive money, polling, and crowd sizes, right? Polling and press. I talk about those kind of three cars all connected. So imagine three cars. You have money, you have press, and you have crowds, and they're all connected by a chain. And so if you have one that's really fast, but the other two suck, it'll slow you down. Yeah. And sometimes they can pull the others forward, but they hold you back. You want them all cranking. And we had none.
We're over three.
But yeah, Liam's like, you should go on tour just to see if, you know, get some content of you speaking and see what happens if crowd-wise, see if you can get used to building for events and such. So we did, and I drove a 15-person passenger van.
It was wild.
Those are awful to drive.
I really felt for you, just like parking that thing.
Oh, man.
It
got towed in Chicago.
Oh, my gosh, it got towed in Chicago. Oh, and my wife, Evelyn, showed up to that event in Chicago with the kids.
I forgot about that. Ev showed up, and then we got these, I basically got a big-ass... they're called a step and repeat, if you will. They use it at these big galas that had like Humanity First Tour on it, like Universal Basic Income, Yang 2020. We tried a couple messages and then we had to get it to all the events. So we actually ended up buying two of them and like flew one that took one to Iowa, one to other places. And there was no trunk space in this van. So like, but the open space in the middle. So we had all the shit in the middle of it. And then Carly and Liam were typically in the back. So we'd go like 4-hour, 10-hour drives, like two of us in the front and two of us literally 15, let's call it 6 rows away in the back. It was very strange. We had these like shitty risers, like milk cartons for Andrew to stand on.
I remember vividly getting on top of the milk carton.
Yeah, and like a shitty AV system because we did these events at like a Detroit, whoever would do it for free. Like Detroit
Bike Factory. Thank you. Thank you, my friend Zach Bashak.
Yeah, they're awesome, really, really good entrepreneurs that like liked you. They'd heard you on Sam Harris or other places. But talk about like we tried to get press to come. No press was coming. Almost. We almost had someone come, but yeah, it was like we just did events that no one gave a shit about.
Like calling local reporters being like, hey, Andrew Yang is coming to town.
Yes. You would take a photo. Because we would get Chicago, we got a couple hundred people, and that was cool. A lot of Sam Harris fans in Chicago, apparently. But we, like Iowa or Detroit, you're not getting more than like 20 to 40. But you'd take the photo like angled over someone's shoulder to make the crowd look bigger, And so that's how you knew. If you ever guys want like a good tip, if you see a politician post a photo and it looks like they've zoomed in tight to the crowd,
it means no one was there.
There was no one there. Yeah, it's a good. Anyway, so that was wild.
Now that tour, wow. So that was one of the defining experiences of 2018.
Oh, we were trying to perfect your stump speech too. Yeah. Get better at that too. But it's hard. It's different than the other speeches you were normally giving.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/RS10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/RS10 today.
Yeah, so around this time, and you start getting into this in the book, is where we start out with a particular thesis, which is that we should go to Andrew's fancy friends who can write checks
and
have events and then ask them for money. The maximum you could give at the time was maybe $2,800, something like that. So if you do some math, you'd be like, hey, you know, you get 20 people to give you $2,800, that's $56,000. Like, you're cooking with gas.
More than a monthly burn, yeah,
so
that's great.
So let's go do that.
Yep.
And then you painstakingly detail in the book why that did not happen. And one of the things that made me laugh out loud was like, so here's the order of operations. I call a friend of mine. I'm like, hey, man, I'm running for president. They're like, yeah, I know. I'll be like, hey, will you have an event for me? And then it's hard to say no to someone when they're on the phone with you when you're their friend. So they're like, sure. So that I then email and be like, thanks, man. CCing my campaign manager, Zach, who could like help plan the event. And then you talk about how they try and like duck
they
you.
Just duck
and
me
like,
for
and
weeks,
like, yeah, like they don't get back to you. And then eventually you move them to get a date on the calendar. And then you say in the book, and then my suffering became theirs. Because then they had the job of trying to get people to come to an event for the Andrew Yang presidential campaign. And they start out with these visions of being like, oh, everyone's going to donate $500 to be there. And then when they find that doesn't work, then they start downgrading it to free.
It's free. They'll donate after they get here. They don't.
Like, Andrew will be so compelling that like that they will.
Yep. Nope. Never happened. It was, there's a whole chapter in there why fundraising for campaigns sucks. It's awful. It's one of the biggest gatekeepers to our shitty political system is that you have to raise money. You have to play the quantity game with rich people because you can't, if you're young, if you're new to this, you can't crowdfund your way to relevance out the gate. Because
everyone thinks you can and you cannot.
You cannot because you need, think about it, you need tens and tens and tens of thousands of people to give you
$5. I'm going to demonstrate for you the logic that everyone uses that is 1,000% wrong.
Do it.
Hey, I've got 10,000 Twitter followers. So if only 10% of them give me $25 each, that means that I'll be able to raise $25,000 by just my Twitter followers if I send a tweet.
Yep.
In real life, how much will that tweet raise for that person?
$200?
Yeah, probably like, you know.
And one person will give
$100. Yeah.
It'll be 10 people max will donate. Unless they're used to donating to you. But even that'd be low.
Yeah. So getting people to donate to our campaign in 2018 was really hand-to-hand combat. We had like a bell we'd ring every time someone donated. Remember that? I would personally send an email or a note to someone, everyone who donated for a while, and then they'd be like, is this real? Real? And I'd be like, well, yeah.
Thank you for your $6 donation.
Thank you. You know, that's one of the things you have to do to try and cultivate early supporters. So, but you write in the book about how the average yield from these events was.
I mean,
you had a number.
I can't remember, $2,300, like something. It was less than the max, I think.
It was like $4,600.
I mean, it was $4,600. It was less than if the couple. That was less than the couple max. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I should get used to nailing my numbers from the book, though, because you were good at that when you talked to me.
One of the funny things too is I would remember an event being a dud because we had lots of dud events.
Yep.
But I couldn't blame you. I couldn't blame my friend. The only person I could blame is me for not being cool enough that people want to donate just to show up and hear me talk, or even donate after hearing me talk because I'm so compelling. So, so from my perspective, it was like, well, no one to blame but myself.
Oh, it was awful. I have a whole chapter, like a page in there on like how the bullshit we would say to ourselves, like each other, to like build each other up.
That was funny too.
Don't worry, man. They'll donate next time. Or, this famous person had heard of you. They're excited. Look at, they're following you on Twitter. Like, you try to distract you, like the bullshit Kool-Aid we were drinking. Yeah.
And then we were like distracting each other, because I will say to you, if I was self-conscious at all, it was not for my own sake, but it was for you, because I'm like, oh shit, Zach might get demoralized if, like, you know, these things
keep
just being duds. Because again, like, I would look in the mirror and be like, well, it's clearly on me for just not being good enough or cool enough. Did you feel self-conscious at the time that you were like, hey, I'm not able to? Probably not. You probably just blamed me too.
I didn't. It was tough to blame you because of how awful it was. You know, it was just honestly. Who did I blame? You didn't know. Like, for me, I'm a big, like, try everything once or as many times as you can.
You didn't blame anyone. That's good, man.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, like, there were times I was like, it was more like, a big thing to me was where I would get mad at is some of the fundraisers or the people being full of shit.
There was so much full of shitness.
Yes.
Like, there's still a couple people.
Like, I'm going to raise you tens of thousands of dollars and, like, nothing.
Oh, no, the worst part is, okay, here's the deal. I have tried to raise money for people and failed.
That shit's hard, though.
And that is acceptable. But if that happens, I damn well better max out.
Yeah.
So at least,
my wife and I at least going to pay more than we thought we would.
That's the egregious thing.
Yes.
Is that if someone really exerts themselves, or no, I mean, they couldn't exert themselves that much because, like, if they're not able to do it, then they just cut the check themselves, which is, by the way, not, you know, what they said they were going to try and do or whatnot.
Right.
And there are people who 1,000% could afford that easily.
Yes, and they didn't. And that's, you know, what was frustrating.
And so that was the frustrating thing for both of us, where we would go to a home, and the home was very fancy. It was easily worth millions and millions of dollars. And then that person would not donate like $1,000 or $2,000, despite opening their home up to friends and then being like, hey, we should support this person. Sometimes even saying, like, I'm supporting them. And then you're
and then
like,
they didn't.
And they didn't. And then you're a little bit like, hey, like, you didn't tell all your friends that you donated. So like, watching things like that unfold, it was a little bit like, you know, like,
no, people are full of shit.
And like, where's the character?
And yes, it was a lack of integrity. And so now, like, I make a note, like, if a friend of mine, it's got to be a good friend, like someone like in my circle, but like if someone asks, like, hey, I'm fundraising, like, I will donate. I'm not rich, so like, I'll give what I can. Because when we did it, there were random friends of mine, like fringe friends or random colleagues or friend of a friend that would be like, I'm in, man, just donated, right? And those people, like, always made me feel a joy. I'm like, thank you. And I had some best friends that didn't do shit. And I call FOSS, full of shit. And that was, we felt that all the time.
Politics brings that out
a lot of people.
It was a step worse for me, I think, as the candidate. So
yeah,
for you,
they were like, I tried my friends, but a very different, like, trying to.
Yeah.
It was
and
a
even
step
for
harder.
You, I mean, you know, you felt strongly about it and you were clearly taking a risk and, you know, right. You were dedicating your career. So if someone loves you and supports you, they'd be like, oh, I should do something else.
Right. Yeah.
But for the candidate, it's like, you know, direct.
Yeah.
So
like, someone says, my friend Andrew's running for office and like, now's the time and I'm not going to donate. They never fucking donate. You know, that's it.
Yeah. And so did I lose friends? Totally.
Yep.
Like, am I still pissed off at like some people that were close to me who just like you could tell were like more concerned about how it would reflect on them?
Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Totally.
Yeah, dude.
So that stuff.
You know what that means, man? They were never actually your friend. That's what I learned when I left UBS. There were people that like essentially stopped answering my calls and texts or stopped coming to things I was throwing. And it's because they were my friend because of like friend of convenience. Now it's like that's a thing in life where it's like you have the same, you know, the same peers. You work at similar types of jobs and neighborhoods and social circles and restaurants and all that bullshit.
You're saying, I thought you were going to use a different word there. I thought you were going to say like friend of like status or friend of utility. Mm. Because if you were, wealth management at UBS, then people would be like, oh, like this person could be really useful.
Oh, if I had my donut suit up. Yeah. Because I was tied to the job or the status or
So when someone takes on a role where they can no longer do things for people and then people then lose interest in that person, so that's like a utility relationship.
Mm-hmm. It's sad.
Yeah, it's sad
because I grew up like my parents were weird and I love them to death. They're fun, they're like great, but they had weird nerdy friends like a lot, and I was always, you know, I was a kid and like, or as I got like in that middle school, high school, too cool for school phase, and I never really understood. But as I got older, I understood my parents have friends that would take a bullet for them, and they still to this day, right? I've thrown surprise parties for my parents, and these friends are the type that will fly from Buffalo or from Connecticut if they're in Florida, wherever it is, to come, and they wouldn't miss that for the world, right? It's like that. They may have like, they may be weird, they may, you know, their kids are weird or like whatever, but a real friend, and my parents never valued that. And it took me a while to learn that. It actually took me leaving UBS to realize what the hell a friend means. Like a friend loves at all times. And that shit's biblical. So it was very, like I wrote about this in the book. No one gives a shit. Most people do not give a shit. They say they do, they act like they do on a high level. But a lot of people, as soon as your utility runs out or the social status runs out, they don't give a shit. And those, the worst part, I'm going ahead, those are the same people they're going to talk about how good of a friend they are to you and how well they know you when you are having success later. You're like, oh, that Andrew, like someone saw my Andrew Yang. Oh, you know, I'm through a fundraiser for him. Or, yeah, I'm close friends. I got a cell phone right here. Fuck you. Pardon my French. But those are the worst. That's the worst. It's just fake. Drive me nuts. Sorry.
Yeah. Though I will say virtually everyone who threw a fundraiser for me, like, you know, like.
The good. Yes. The ones who, I mean, down the stretch is a shock. I'm like, certain, like we'd go to fundraisers and raise $100,000. You're like.
Yes.
Mind blowing down the stretch. Yeah.
Now, so during 2018, what was like the darkest moment for you, if you had one? Do you remember? Because you write that there's like the chapter in the book.
2018 darkest moment.
Because so, and we're going to talk about the in the next chapter of this conversation, like the turning point of the campaign, when it went positive,
yep.
And then like what the lessons you had. So the book goes through. I'd say several phases, and phase one is like the dark days, essentially.
Mm-hmm. The darkest. So there was still like that hope and optimism in the early days, right? And then Sam Harris was a healthy lift, and that was June, I think, May.
Yeah.
And so there was this hope that if we got the message out there to the right audiences or any big audience in the right format, it would work. Because we raised a good amount of money and had some decent crowds. I mean, 100 people in Chicago, or almost 300 people in Chicago, if I recall, that's bigger than everybody but the top six candidates at the time were getting in terms of crowd sizes. Pretty much, yeah. So like we had that, we didn't have legitimacy, but I would say the darkest days were sometime between Sam Harris and before we found out we were going on Joe Rogan, because it was like I don't see a
late 2018 was a difficult time.
Yes.
So the summer, I'm on Sam Harris, and then right out of that, I get invited to speak at the Iowa Wing Ding.
That's right.
Which felt like a big deal.
Yes.
And the fact that I went to the Iowa Wing Ding is probably what eventually landed us on the. Iowa poll that ended up determining debate qualification.
That was New Year's or so when we found out.
Yeah, but for whatever reason, we had a running joke that you didn't like Iowa because like you were tied up that weekend.
My brother got married that weekend.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
I was so pumped to go, and it was my brother's wedding, and I was like,
obviously,
Jordan would be fine if I missed rehearsal dinner, and you're like, dude, stop.
Yeah, just go to the wedding.
Stop. I was the best man. Like, please stop.
yeah, totally.
So we're like, we're not having this conversation. You're missing Iowa.
I go to Iowa, and then there's this period during the summer where it feels like we're making headway. But then like, the end of 2018, I thought, was a tough time. And the midterms really ended up blotting out a lot of political energy. Like no one, because like the only people in the field at the time, I think, were like John Delaney and me. And so like no one was thinking about it. But one of the tougher times, and we managed to frame it positively, is we had a New Year's fundraiser that year that lost money. At least one person asked for a refund because they were, you know, so disappointed in.
Now the refund, she was. I don't think she was justified in the refund. The party wasn't that bad. Like we did have open bar and food and decent crowd. But yeah, we did lose money. Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah, so you know, it failed on its own terms because it was theoretically a fundraiser. It was theoretically a fundraiser. It was definitely a camera angle type thing. So we, you know, took some good pictures. But I remember that this person was disappointed enough, and I think it was like a. What pained me about her was that she was clearly a supporter, and then she showed up, and because it didn't feel like real enough, she actually felt like it reflected negatively on her that she was.
I can't believe I would support this or whatever.
Yeah, because like you know, it didn't feel like you know, like it was significant enough. And so then we gave her a refund, and we're like, yeah, I'm sure, sorry.
Of course, yeah.
But I do remember thinking, it's like, well, this is not a good sign, because I'd thrown New Year's Eve parties that made money, you know, as just like just as a party.
Yes. That was my biggest thing. A lot of people didn't want to spend New Year's related to politics in the slightest, as in hindsight, learned that. But I will say this, like I say this as a friend, like, and I can say this in hindsight now, like knowing you better. you were taking a lot of the stress and weight of the campaign personally during those times. Like, you were not as probably happy as I saw you. From June 2000, or let's call it May, post Joe Rogan is a bit of a roller coaster. Like, it's not fair to evaluate anyone's personality during that like year stretch. But knowing you and like your normal baseline of happiness, like you were like stressed then, taking a lot of this shit personally. It wasn't every day, but it was hard on you. It was hard on all of us. The dog days of the campaign was like winter 2018.
Winter 2018 was the tough.
Yeah.
No one cared.
Midterms had just happened, and we're always like, after midterms, everyone will care, and no one was fucking caring.
The new candidates were declaring all the time, we were not part of the conversation. I'd show up to something, and like people would totally, if not ignore me, like definitely there was like a lot of tacit snubbing going on.
Yep. Oh man, it was. I have a sample email. It's a verbatim email that I wrote to a reporter who like left you. Like the only, it was like basically Julian Castro, I think, announced. And it was like the only other candidate who's announced his campaign is John Delaney. And I was like, and us, remember us, talk about us. We were the free hugs guy in their eyes. You know, so I talk about this. Like we had to, this is like a point of the book. So we had to compete not just with, it's like 1,500 Democrats, I think, that run for office every year. It's 3,000 people across the party run for president every cycle. And there are only like 29, let's call it, major candidates. So what's the difference between those 29 and the other thousands? It's legitimacy. And so the free hugs guy runs. There was a woman named Lisa Simpson we met who legally changed her name to be like the Simpsons character. Like she's running for office. Like Yang was that to some in the early days. And to be fair, there wasn't much difference on paper besides, I mean, you were an impressive guy, but some of these people are, you know, regular business folks. And we had raised some money, but we were trying to get out of that, you know, and that was hard. And that was the thing. So we learned this very quickly and painfully, was that we are in the attention economy, which means attention is the most valuable resource. In order to get all the other resources you like time and money, attention is it. And what does that mean? It didn't mean we weren't just competing with the other candidates, not only the free hugs guy, we weren't competing against Liz Warren and Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders and the usual suspects alone. We were also competing against Taylor Swift and Kim Kardashian and the HBO hit series, whatever it is that Friday night, and Netflix and whatever, Spotify, whatever is your friends are texting you, everything that you're getting information loaded onto you, we had to compete with that too. And that actually changed the equation because we didn't have to be, if we didn't do everything Kirsten Gillibrand was doing, it actually didn't matter because no one was paying attention to her either. We just had to stand out. And get people to realize we existed. And so that kind of flipped the mentality. It was like, I ended up calling it, create an identity brand where people can identify with Andrew to make you relevant.
Which ended up being the birth of the Yang Gang, which you can take direct credit for because though it was an organic internet.
Someone on the internet.
Creation
really created it, but yeah.
But then you built on it despite some resistance.
The team hated it
internally. So, so the next segment of this conversation is going to be essentially like when the dynamic shifts and we grow and all of that. But give us a glimpse of what ends up fueling the campaign's ascent, as chronicled in Long Shot.
With Kizik hands-free shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy-on, easy-off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
So how do you compete in the attention economy? Two ways, volume and relevance. Volume is like Bud Light marketing, which I talk about in the book, is that when people just beat you into submission with their ads or their content, right? It's why Target emails you 20 times a day or Bud Light has 1,000 commercials. It's not because they have anything new to offer. They just want you to know they're there. We did not have enough money to do volume. So we had to go the relevance route. We had to make you relevant, and relevant to who? And we needed to make you relevant to people that would easily connect. So we created what I call identity branding, where folks identify with you. And the ways I talk about the book, where you create a like us persona, you find your tribe and you let them in. And so the like us persona was branding you in a way that I felt like you say, like us in front of us, like us, we are forward looking and logical. I mean, like math, or an entrepreneur or whatever it is, right? I mean, you could say that about any, there's a lot of good brand, like Target, Disney, they do this well, right? But letting people know this is where we are, like us, you can be like us. And then we had to go find them. And finding them, we really wanted something that was visceral, where people could identify with. So if you think about 2016, as it was the recent example we were looking at, it was like, if you were voting for John Kasich or Ted Cruz, what would you say? Like, am I team Kasich or I'm voting for Ted? There was nothing there. But Trump, what would you say? Like, people would say, I'm MAGA. Or sometimes I'm on the Trump train, but I'm MAGA, make America great again. And it was this visceral, like right here. People felt connected to the Donald. So we wanted that. And someone posted, like, so Andrew's army felt lame. Team Andrew didn't work. And then we saw Yang, like hashtag Yang Gang on a, like one of our early posts. And I was like, that's it. That's it. Because it's visceral. And you can say, I'm Yang Gang. Or like, I'm kind of Yang Gang. Am I in the, you can say using a sentence better. And I remember saying to the team, like, we're calling it Yang Gang, and they hated it. Like, Carly was like, you know, it sounds like gang bang, like no one's gonna like it, it's weird. And then I remember saying, all right, fine. You kept to come up with a better idea in, like, I think it was like 10 days or a week, or if not, we're going with Yang Gang. And they didn't, because it was good. It was good for us. You know, I wouldn't recommend Joe Biden calling, like, having a gang, but for us, it was a way to rally our supporters and help them feel part of the campaign. And then from there on, we had to go find that tribe. Because actually, when we first announced Yang Gang, it didn't like take off. It was like a slow burn, if you will. If you, I don't know if you remember correctly. But
so approximately what month was this?
It was probably early January. I think we did a Yang Gang. We started using it in early January 2019. And I think we wanted to up our, just, we just thought it was better to have more donors from our email list. So we actually started taking Venmo.
I remember trying to take money through Venmo, but I kind of was like, oh, we should do it totally, because that's like the easiest thing for a young person.
So we then got people giving us $1 via Venmo, which is, we violated a whole bunch of FEC rules doing that. We had to go back and
paper it up. It's fine. Yeah, it's fine. Got the info.
Fine. It was great, because we had like a, you know, 5,000 person email list, and it got us like 50% of that email list eventually donated, which is really good if, like, for numbers wise, because it was so simple, just click and send a Venmo dollar.
Well, this truly is the beginning of the rise, because it's January 2019, and around then they announced the criteria to get on the debate stage, which was the push to get 65,000 individual donors.
Sam Harris helped a lot. We knew like what we wanted to be, and then we just needed to find them. And so the traditional playbook, where you get the pundits and the endorsers and the mainstream media and the high dollar donors and the political consultants, we weren't getting any of those. So we had to go the other way. When we went podcasts and alternative media and social media.
I do a lot of Wired and tech press.
Yep. When I say we built the Yang Gang in the book, I say we built the Yang Gang with podcasts, memes, and math. And so podcasts were like this long form way to get your message out with people who were more ripe to hear it, I think. And you got really good at talking on podcasts. You had a lot of practice in 2018, and Sam Harris, you really refined it. And by Joe Rogan, you were in your zone. You pretty much did all of them in middle of 2019, all your big ones. And then memes were like a fun way to let the Yang Gang in, where they could make, my favorite meme I talk about in the book, and you guys can find this, it's like the Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator meme, where he's riding a motorcycle next to a, and there's He's saving John Connor, who's also riding a motorcycle, and there's a big semi truck coming and is about to crush John Connor, and Terminator comes up and pulls him out of the way, and the truck crushes John Connor's motorcycle, and it's like Andrew Yang's John Connor, and the truck is automation, and John Connor, or Andrew Yang's the Terminator saving John Connor. John Connor's the American economy, or whatever it is. But we post
American
that.
Worker.
We post that on the official Yang, like, social accounts. And it was like, Yang can meme. It was like one of the first. And that was like Rock Toaster, whatever his name was on Twitter. It was like the handle. It was pretty funny. But we started just leaning into memes all the time. And they were a really good way to, like, make it fun, secure the bag, like, stuff like that started coming out. And we just, like, if the Yang Gang posts something fun, we fired it up, right? We leaned into it. In the beginning, you were still like a business speaker, you know? And I joke in the, we were trying to get you to fire up the crowd. And it's like not your natural, you can do really well now, but at the beginning, it's not, you never had to really.
Yeah, no. Like, hitting emotional chords was not the
fucking
tenor.
Skill. And so we were trying to get you, like, fire people up, and you were just like, to your credit, like, really trying to figure this out. And you, like, give all your, you know, your speech, and everybody's captivated. And then you're like, now who's with me? Or whatever. Like, you were like, it was like kind of, it wasn't landing. And Frawley had the idea. He was like, why don't we just give people math signs? Like, what? He's like, yeah. So when he says numbers, people can be like, math. And we're like, I don't know, that might be fucking brilliant, man.
So it was in Baltimore, right?
It was right after Joe Rogan. We hadn't really hit yet because it just came out, right? But it was a decent crowd and a couple hundred people. And we had fucked up so many ways in this rally. Like, so first of all, we had the signs and we forgot to print them double-sided. So the photos of the back of the crowd is just a white piece of paper up there. Like, oh, fuck, hold them backwards. It was awful. But then we did the other thing we fucked up. We didn't tell you that we were doing this math thing. So you're like, oh, I've looked at the numbers. And then all the crowd just starts going, math. And you're like, huh. And then they went nuts again. Like, yeah. And you're like, fuck yeah, let's do some fucking math. And, like, plays some nuts. We're like, all right, we nailed this. But it was also, you know, it was a, I loved it because it just hit this shitty stereotype we dealt with all time right on the fucking nose, you know, where people are like, oh, you're an Asian guy. You must, you know, like, numbers, or you're doing the math. Then you're like, well, fuck yeah, I'm just gonna lean into it. Like, you know, you can't, you're gonna use it, like, tease me or just diminish me. Like, fuck you, I'll wear a math hat. I'll wear a math pin. Like, screw you. And it was awesome because, like, whoa, all right. Like, well, you beat me to the punch there. Let's talk about something else, right? It was, I love stuff that diffuses a bomb like that. And it was, I'm a big believer in, like, leaning into you authentically. And the fact was, you did use a lot of numbers. You did, like,
I do use a lot of numbers.
You know, some woman at, like, a media outlet was like, don't use math. I've worked in brand marketing forever. I'll never catch on. Like, man, well, screw you. we got bad advice all the time.
It caught on. So on the next podcast, which is going to be on Thursday, we're going to talk about the rise 2019, the debates and all of that. But in the meantime, get your own copy of Long Shot, How Political Nobodies, that's Zach, took Andrew Yang, that's me, National, and the new playbook that let us build a movement, by first-time author, I'm sure not the last, Zach Grauman. Zach, congratulations. The book is tremendous. I had a blast reading it. It was a trip down memory lane for me, but anyone who had any investment emotionally in our campaign is going to love it. And it truly is the book that a lot of people hoped I would write. And as usual, you did it and I didn't. Congrats, man. I'm so pumped for this to be in people's hands.
Thanks, man. To be continued, huh?